2021. Clackamas County is abiding by social distancing requirements during the corona pandemic. So this public hearing, well, it's really not a hearing, it's a work session, but this gathering, I don't know, will be conducted virtually using the Zoom platform. It will, in fact, be recorded, I believe. And if you have a question, please use the raise hand feature. Okay, very good. It is being recorded. I get it. All right. So to begin with, before we take a roll call, really excited to welcome back Carrie Pack and Stephen Trottle. Yay. So happy to have you here again. And we have a new member, Kevin Moss. And can you take a few minutes, Kevin? I know you gave some of us your background, but you can elaborate at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin Moss. I've lived in Clackamas County almost my entire lifetime. I worked for Clackamas County from 2013 to 2020 in the Public and Government Affairs Department as an admin assistant leading the advisory boards and commissions database and working with all the departments. And then in 2015, I was hired by the Board of County Commissioners Office County Administration as a administrative assistant to support the need of the office. And from there, I rose up and kind of served in a kind of deputy clerk to the board role. So I was running the board meetings and policy sessions, executive sessions for the commissioners. And then in April of last year, I took a job with the Washington County Board of Commissioners to be their full-time clerk to the board. So now I run all of their board meetings, work sessions, executive meetings, state legislative appointments, and any meeting they see fit, working on their budget committee right now, running their meetings via the Zoom. So I'm excited to, you know, still reside in Clackamas County and now no longer be a Clackamas County employee, can actually give back to the community and serve in this role on the Planning Commission. So I'm excited to be here and serve with all of you.
Welcome. Great. Okay, to make it official, Darcy, do you want to do a roll call, please?
Excuse me. Commissioner Lopes? I'm present here. Commissioner Peterson?
Present.
Commissioner Pasco?
Present.
Commissioner Wilson?
Present.
Commissioner Schrodel?
Present.
Commissioner Pack?
Present.
Commissioner Murphy?
Present.
Commissioner Moss?
Present.
And Commissioner Stevens?
Present. Thank you, Darcy, very much. All right, let's launch on. I don't see that we have any attendees, but public comment, or this is also an opportunity if any of the commission would like to add anything to the agenda that's not already there. We can do that. Okay. Let's rock and roll. Oh, wow. Election of officers. I don't remember how to do this. So could someone do that, please?
I think essentially you can just open the floor for nominations. We need to elect both a vice chair and a chair. Those are both one year gigs that end on the end of April each year. And we don't have our current chair is not term limited at this point. The bylaws do provide that a chair can only serve two consecutive terms and then needs to take a break. So this is Tammy's first term. And our vice chair was Commissioner Phillips, who, as we all know, had to resign her position due to some work conflicts. And so that was going to be open anyway. I mean, it's open for two reasons, because she resigned and because we're at the end of the year. So we'll need to elect both. And I don't know that the bylaws really say that it has to be in any particular order, whether you want to do the chair, maybe do the chair first, but I don't know that it matters.
Okay.
Darcy's shaking her head. I think you can do whatever you want.
Okay. Let's open the floor for nominations for chair.
Can I just go ahead and move that we reappoint Commissioner Stevens as chair of the commission
and that we
elect Commissioner Murphy as vice chair of the commission?
Do we have a second? I think Stephen Strodel jumped in with a second.
A second for both.
Wonderful. Thanks, Stephen, very much. Any further discussion? So do we just take a vote? Well, okay. All right. Darcy?
There's no... Did somebody want to say something?
There's no hands up.
I have nothing to say. If you're ready to move to a vote,
I'm excited to have a few beats filling this role. Okay. So in the matter of reappointing Commissioner Stevens as chair and Commissioner Murphy as vice chair, Commissioner Peterson?
Yes.
Commissioner Pascoe?
Yes. Sorry.
Commissioner Wilson?
Unmute.
I'll come back around to him.
I vote in the affirmative.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Pack?
Yes.
Commissioner Lopes?
Yes.
Commissioner Schrodel?
Yep. Yes.
Commissioner Moss?
Yes.
And then I do not believe that Commissioner Stevens or Murphy can vote for themselves, but you can vote for each other.
No, Darcy, they can vote for themselves because it's a vote for everyone.
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Commissioner Stevens?
Yes. Thank you. Wonderful. All right. Well.
You know how easy that was?
That was a tough decision.
It should always be so easy.
Wonderful. Okay.
The other seven aren't saying is, I don't want to do it. This is perfect.
I've been there, done that.
Wonderful. All right. Let's launch our resident expert in environmental regulations, Jennifer Hughes. Oh, boy. I'll bet you are just like on the verge of extreme knowledge on this topic.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. I actually told a couple. I was in the office earlier today. I'm home now, but I told a couple people when I walked by, I said, I think I have a teaspoon of knowledge and they're expecting an ocean. So that tells you where I'm approaching this from. But yes, we're going to get started. I did want to say, it's not on the agenda, but I wanted to mention that we discovered something recently about Zoom that it isn't important tonight because there are no attendees in the audience tonight. But it's interesting, we've been doing these webinar-style meetings at the board, and of course, Kevin may tell me there's a workaround, in which case I want to hear what it is. But our tech folks have researched this, and apparently it's been this way for a year and nobody ever knew it. So then I went and looked at a planning commission recording and went, oh, yeah, it is like that. So what happens is when you are in the audience watching the webinar, you see all the pictures that are the videos, right? So they can see me, Darcy, Tammy. They can't see the boxes of the people who aren't on camera. So if you are just a phone-in person, we see it. We see the phone number or if they've put a name in or whatnot so that we know they're there. The audience doesn't see those. They can hear you, but they cannot see that you're there. So it can create some kind of interesting, like people appearing to pop in and out of the meeting because you'll all of a sudden have this sort of disembodied voice or someone will have their camera off and then they will turn their camera on and it's like, oh, look, all of a sudden Jennifer's there. Where was she? So anyway, our people in our cable folks have tried to figure this out at the board level and have said that there is not a workaround. Kevin, if there is, I want you to explain it to me offline. But that would be great, or tonight when we have discussion at the end or something. But bottom line, I just think when we have audience, until we're able to be in person again, we probably want to be pretty intentional at the beginning of the meeting of just explaining to folks kind of what they're going to hear and what they're going to see. And, you know, I'm not saying all members have to be on camera all the time, but just be aware when you're not on camera, they won't necessarily know you're there until you start speaking. So it would be good to just sort of say, hey, this is Commissioner Schrodel talking now, you know, or whatever, so that the audience has a sense of what's going on.
So, like right now, Stephen does have a picture. Would they not see him now, even though he has a picture up?
I don't know. When I looked at it, I think what I know for sure is if it's just the name and the, you know, just shows that you've called in, it doesn't show up. I don't know if you've got that picture there, if it does, but we can test it. Well, yeah, we can actually look when the video is done tonight. We'll be able to find – Darcy can check it tomorrow. I'll volunteer Darcy to check it tomorrow. Because I went back and looked at one from, like, January just to get a sense. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what's happening, you know. And I'm thinking it's been a year and nobody apparently ever realized this was the case, you know, with these. So, and then regarding Zoom in general, I still don't know for sure when we're going to be able to go back in person. But just be aware, it's on my radar. We are going to keep monitoring, like, when the, you know, I've lost track at the moment about what the capacity limits are and, you know, all of that in terms of the hearing room. And we're not set up in the, in your regular hearing room to do a hybrid, Zoom and in person. That technology does not exist in that room. And so to the extent that they ultimately change that, then we might be able to do hybrid, but as it stands now, we would need to go back fully in person and expect everyone to be there. And I do feel like we're moving toward that, you know, given what's kind of generally going on with the messaging that we're getting. But it's not going to happen right away. And, you know, maybe by fall is what I'm tentatively thinking might be realistic. So we'll add something to the script before your June hearing that kind of gets at this Zoom issue a little bit, just so people kind of, if they do happen to be in the audience and not a panel, you know, a panel member, they won't wonder what's going on. So, anyway.
Well, and I know that the auditorium isn't set up yet for the, what do you call it, where it's both things, you're live, but you're all.
Yeah, like the hybrid.
Okay. But, I mean, there are other options. Like tonight isn't a hearing, it's a work study. Mm-hmm. So, and maybe in the future, we do study sessions on Zoom and hearings in person. I mean, hopefully we'll be able to, as a commission, decide if we want that kind of flexibility.
Right.
That would be neat as well. So.
Right. Yeah, we don't necessarily have to make everything 100%. I mean, I think the county is going to be answering some of those questions, that certain meetings, certain advisory boards and commissions might continue just meet via Zoom because it's more convenient, and they very seldom, if ever, have members of the public that participate anyway. Even though they're technically public meetings, people just aren't showing up for those. Obviously, as you know, you have some where a lot of public shows up, just depending upon the issue. So I think we're open to various options because it does help with. And sometimes it helps with participation and commute times and getting here after work and, you know, all of that thing for volunteers that can be useful to continue to do Zoom in some situations. So, anyway.
Okay, before you launch, Jennifer, just to kind of get Kevin up to speed, I can't remember when it was. I want to say it was like last fall. We had a hearing on some property over in the Estacada area. And especially Carrie brought up a lot of questions about whether there's a creek back there and there's some forest back there, and then ultimately said, I want to know more about the county environmental regulations, as, you know, whether it's on zoned, not agriculture, what I want to say, timber, ag, resource lands or not. And so that's kind of, I think, where this all came from, was that desire for this commission to understand more of the regulations at Clackamas County, whether it be resource land or not. So am I hitting that pretty close to the head? Okay. So that's why we're doing that.
Yeah, I was not at that particular hearing, but I think it was Martha and Melissa had mentioned that you had this interest. And so whether I'm giving you less than what you wanted, more than what you wanted, different than what you wanted, I'm going to jump in and we'll, as I said in my brief memo, you may well have questions I don't have the answers to. I am not the technical expert. There is, frankly, no technical expert at Clackamas County in everything we're going to talk about. I mean, that's potentially covered by these regulations, but there are experts that know a lot more than I do. There's a lot of different pieces to how these regulations work. And so we'll just kind of share, and if you have questions that I can't answer, I will try to get you the answers when I can, or tell you, like, sorry, we really don't have anybody who knows the answer to that. And we could certainly have follow-up with, you know, with different staff or whatnot. If there's a particular area that you want to dive into more where we do have some additional expertise, we can certainly talk about providing that. So I'm going to attempt to share my screen. And I just have a very simple PowerPoint to talk from, and I'm not sure once I do that whether I can really see your raised hands or what. Let's see.
You'll still be able to see them.
Will I? Perfect.
Yeah.
I never do this. I always have other people sharing screen. Okay, so can everyone see that? Yes. Okay. So Darcy's going to leave, so I just want to make sure I have all the tech I need. So what I see, Darcy, is everybody's little pictures in the corner, which I can, or on the side, which I can scroll through. But I don't know where my my raised hand. But I guess Tammy, you can see that.
I have double screen at home, so I have the participants on another screen, and I can
perfect.
See anyone raises their hand. So I'll be mindful to watch that.
Because I could keep digging around, but I'm just wasting all of your time. So if you can handle that, that'd be awesome. And just tell me to be quiet at some point if I just keep going. I'll try to pause in certain.
Sorry. If somebody does raise their hand, their little screen icon will jump up to the top.
Oh, okay.
You'll see a little hand in the corner.
Oh, like Tom just did. Perfect.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Okay, Darcy, thank you very much. Enjoy your evening.
Thank you, Jen.
Hi, Darcy. Thank you.
All right. So also I will try to pause in certain places where I think like this might be a logical place to take questions because it is a lot of information. So the first question I have is, hey, Murph, can you tell everybody what this picture is? I figure you probably know what it is. I just stole it out of one of Steve Henschke's PowerPoints.
Absolutely. This is just above the intersection of East Barlow Trail and East Lolo Pass Road. The Sandy River runs against Lolo Pass Road before it crosses underneath it and starts heading west. And this particular area is not, or the road is not elevated, as you can see, off the river's elevation. So it's actually part of the floodplain itself. So when the river does have an event such as this 2011 event, it can spread and take out the road. Currently, there is a revetment that was put in by Clackamas County to protect this, and there's another one that's planned this summer. They're going to put in about another 800 feet of revetment, which is a rock and log bio type of protection for this road. So they're working on this particular area. But this was the very beginning of getting me very involved in this, in figuring out what was going on. Just above this area, there was an avulsion, and that's where land is absorbed by the river, whether it be an oxbow is cut off or whatever. But this mass of log and cobble came down the river, and in many locations, it raised the bed elevation. And when it did that, the river just took off in all different directions, including in my neighborhood. There was areas where it had raised the riverbed elevation as high as 12 feet. And this is all a natural occurrence in a volcanic river that has multiple lahars in it. This is very similar, which something that we had seen in Toodle River. So this is bringing nutrient, this is bringing spawning cobble and sand down for salmon. It's creating one of the richest areas down at the mouth of the Columbia River. Our estuaries are probably one of the richest in the world because of this type of activity. Okay, take it away.
So see, I told you there were people who knew a lot more than I did. But I guess partly I took this picture because, frankly, it was easy, and I'm not great at PowerPoint. You'll see this like the only graphic in the whole presentation. And I was throwing this together today because, you know, I have this vision of spending hours on this. And in my position, I can't do that. There's too much stuff coming at me. So it was like, all right, I'm putting together a simple PowerPoint. And I borrowed this picture, and I thought, well, you know, in a way, this is actually kind of illustrative of a point I'm going to make, which is that there is this sort of bureaucratic construct, if you will, behind where our regulations all come from out of the statewide planning goals. And yet, they all intersect. So whether we're protecting people or we're protecting you know, the natural environment, the habitat, whether we're approaching it from a hazard standpoint or a kind of environmental protection standpoint, they all overlap. And it's becoming increasingly difficult, frankly, to keep pretending that they don't. And so it's kind of frustrating at the staff level sometimes, and I'll explain that a little bit more. And there are some changes coming, as Murph is well aware, to the floodplain program, where it's going to be abundantly clear that they intersect. So even though this is a flood picture, it's also an environment picture. Okay, let's see if I can get my slide to advance here. No, of course not. It worked just fine a second ago when I tested it. Now, naturally, I can't get it to advance. Nails. Sorry, hang on here. Oh, whoop. It did it, but not the way I thought it would, and too far ahead. So let's see. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to have to do my trackpad, and it'll go too fast, and I'll have to back up because my arrow isn't working like it was before. So the statewide plan goals, I don't want to dumb this down too much. I know a lot of you already know a lot of this, so I guess apologies if I'm being overly basic in some of this, but I guess I do just want to start with, remember, everyone, we have these statewide planning goals. There are 19 of them. Only 15 of them apply in Clackamas County. So the other four are coastal goals and apply to, you know, counties and cities on the coast, but not to us. So of those, there are several that pertain to what I would call environmental or at least environmentally related programs. So the first one, and the one that we probably as planners anyway talk about the most, is Goal 5. Goal 5, that's just the title of it, Natural Resources, Scenic and Historic Areas, and Open Spaces. And there are actually 15 different resource categories that have been established under this goal, again, at the state level. And they are not all environmental. They run the gamut. Most of them have some relationship to the natural environment. So I am just going to go ahead and read the list because I think it's kind of interesting. Riparian corridors, wetlands, wildlife habitat, federal wild and scenic rivers, state scenic waterways, groundwater resources, approved Oregon recreation trails, natural areas, wilderness areas, mineral and aggregate resources. Okay, that's kind of an odd one, right? That doesn't really seem to fit with the rest necessarily. Energy sources, cultural areas. So those are all the ones that are, to some degree anyway, mandatory that we do something about it. Then there are three additional ones which are optional. Historic resources, open space, and scenic views and sites. I am not going to talk about all 15, thankfully, for you and for me. But I'm going to focus on the ones where we have kind of what I would describe as the most robust regulations that are sort of locally implemented, you know, through our zoning code. Because frankly, some of these are not, I don't really understand exactly how the county is compliant with a few of those. We are, but honestly, some of them haven't been revisited in so long and the requirements aren't as robust. And so, you know, we have some policies in our comp plan and some, you know, some ways that we, you know, the state found us to be compliant back in the 80s. But they aren't necessarily real meaningful programs today. Right, wrong, or indifferent, that's kind of how it is. And there are other ones where it's like, no, we do this every day. And we have very robust regulations and there have been amendments over the years to modernize them and all of that. I'm also tonight only going to focus on the ones that are related to environmental regulations. So the county certainly does have a program for mineral and aggregate sites, which you've all, you know, many of you have experienced being on the Planning Commission. And we also have a historic, even though it's optional, the county did choose to do that. And we have a program for historic resources, which, of course, Mary was a big advocate for when she was on the commission. But obviously, that's not the focus of the presentation tonight. So what's important, I think, to recognize about Goal 5 is that there is, for many of the resources anyway, a very prescribed process for how you protect things under Goal 5. So if somebody comes in to you, for instance, and they've got an application for a comp plan amendment and a zone change, and you say, hey, I'm worried about this stream on here. And we say, well, it's not a Goal 5 resource. The county isn't able to, through this process of I've come for a zone change, decide that you're going to protect it under Goal 5. It doesn't work that way. So there has to be what's called an inventory, and some inventories are done locally. Some are actually done by the state and provided to counties that says, hey, this is every, we went out and looked and this is what we found. You know, are we 100% sure that we've found every wetland in the state of Oregon? Nope. In fact, I'm sure we haven't. But there is an inventory somewhere that someone said, yeah, this is it. This is the inventory for purposes of this program. Then the second piece is what's called a significance determination. So you have some criteria, and it's, you know, there's some discretion here, but some determination with wetlands, it's actually the state that decides what does and doesn't qualify as significant. But there's a process of saying, okay, this is our determination of what qualifies as significant. So like for historic resources, we have this big checklist, they earn points, and at some point it's significant. Once you determine that it's significant, you have to do what's called an easy analysis. And I'm going to get them probably in the wrong order, but it's energy, it's like the energy, social, economic, and environmental factors, essentially, that you evaluate and weigh between protecting the resource, whatever it is. So here's this wetland, and we're going to look at what else might happen on this property. What are the potential conflicting uses that could happen here? Oh, well, look, it's zoned industrial in one of our premier urban industrial zones that we want jobs. So you start comparing, essentially, what are the consequences of protecting the wetland over allowing the land to be developed for industrial uses in this example. And there's this analysis that's done. And in the end, you find we're finding in favor of protecting the resource completely, no development in the wetland. We're finding in favor of limiting. So we might allow some development on a piece of property, say that has a stream corridor, but maybe you don't get to develop every bit of it. Or we can find in favor of, nope, the conflicting use is more important and we're not going to protect the resource. So it isn't just a 100% the environmental piece necessarily prevails. It's an evaluation that happens. So once that's been determined, then the program's adopted and we protect or don't protect or partially protect whatever that particular Goal 5 resource is. Okay? So that's, I mean, I'll talk more specifically about our actual regulations in some of these areas, but that's the concept of how Goal 5 works. Okay. Okay. So as I said, there are several goals that all deal kind of somewhat interrelatedly with environmental features. The second one is Goal 6, air, water, and land resources quality. I will tell you, this one is far less, I think, far less well understood than Goal 5. There are actually no administrative rules that the state has adopted to implement this goal, which tells you it's not really as specific. I mean, there are pages and pages and pages of rules about how you implement Goal 5. Goal 6 just is this, the goal itself, which is pretty general language, pretty aspirational. So what does that really mean? And all I've given you there is what the rule says falls within this goal. So, you know, it's a variety of things that might pollute air, water, and land resources. So yes, that's implemented. I mean, we were acknowledged by the state as being in compliance with Goal 6. But I would be hard-pressed to sit you down and tell you every place in our zoning code or our comp plan that fully implements this goal. I think the bottom line is it's little pieces of things. Yes, the county has a noise ordinance. Yes, we have standards that relate to solid waste disposal. Yes, we evaluate things in the context of, say, a conditional use permit that would get at some of these issues. But for the most part, when you're talking about pollution, really, it's the state and the federal government that is in the driver's seat with that. The county is not independently implementing air quality requirements, for example. Where this is a little bit different is in the water quality piece, and we'll talk about that more shortly. Okay, so the third one is Goal 7, and this gets back at that first slide where I said there's this intersection between natural hazards that are really perceived more about what they do to people and to our built environment, and the more sort of environmental protection regulations. Goal 7 covers just what's listed here: floods, landslides, earthquakes, tsunamis, coastal erosion, and wildfires. Obviously, a couple of those do not apply in Clackamas County. Fortunately, we're not needing to worry about coastal erosion or tsunamis, but the other ones pertain to us. Again, there are no administrative rules that the Department of Land Conservation and Development has adopted to implement Goal 7. It's just the goal. We do at the county have robust regulations related to floods, and we're going to talk about that more specifically in a little while. And we have some regulations related to landslides, and we have something that ostensibly relates to wildfires, but I will tell you it is not robust, and it is not really able to be implemented very effectively because it's so old. We do not have any standards related to earthquakes. I mean, there's building codes, obviously, but as far as like from a land use perspective. So then the fourth goal that relates again to this broad category of environmental regulations is Goal 15. This was actually, there were 14 goals originally, and then Goal 15 was added about a year later. This was back in the 70s, though, for the Willamette River Greenway. So that applies to our entire stretch of the Willamette River that's in unincorporated Clackamas County, and all of the communities that have land along the Willamette River, cities and counties, were required to have a program with a mapped greenway. That it's interesting because I've listed here kind of what the main factors are that the goal attempts to get at. So it does talk about habitat and vegetation preservation, but honestly, that is not the primary focus of the regulations that we have for the greenway. It was really at the state level envisioned, I think, as a way of prioritizing the acquisition of parkland along the river. And there was state funding for that, but it was not maintained over the years. So there isn't, to my knowledge, any, it didn't sound like from what I could glean today from the state's website that there's any particular program now charged with buying up land along the greenway. There's also a focus on maintaining access to the river. So both physical access, right, for people to be able to recreate on the river or be near the river, and visual access, so the scenic value of the river. And it's from the perspective both of people who are on the water and people who are on the land. So the perspective of, well, I'm boating on the river, I should have some access to riverbanks potentially. I should be looking at something scenic from when I'm out at the river rather than necessarily everything being heavily developed. And so it looks at it really from both perspectives. So yes, there is a buffer. There is this habitat vegetation preservation, but it's really not at this point our primary way of protecting the habitat value is really not through the greenway. There's overlapping regulations now that kind of do a better job of that. And it does direct development away from the river in the sense that there is a setback requirement for development, and there's a building height limit and some limits on, you know, like using earth tones for certain construction and that kind of thing. So there is something about protecting the scenic value, you know, from the river in terms of what you're seeing when you look at the shoreline. Okay, so those are the four statewide planning goals that I wanted to focus on. And I guess just to maybe sum up that part, yes, the county is required to comply with the statewide planning goals. We will talk about how that really works in terms of timing in a little while. But before I move on, are there questions about the state piece? Nope. Okay. So then we get to Metro, right? So that's our next layer. The Metro government has regulations that apply to cities and counties within the metro boundary. The metro boundary is not identical to the Portland Metropolitan Urban Growth Boundary. It's very similar, but it's not identical. So for the most part, the metro boundary is a little bit larger than the urban growth boundary. There are some areas outside the urban growth boundary, I believe in Oregon City, that area that are in metro, the whole Stafford, the Stafford Triangle, plus even some of Stafford that's south of I-205 is in the metro boundary, even though it's not in the urban growth boundary at this point. Area out toward Boring, which I'm sure Brian could is aware of, that's, you know, inside the metro boundary that isn't in the urban growth boundary. So, and then there are, I think, a few oddities where there's actually random pieces that are in the urban growth boundary that aren't in metro, which is very strange. But in any event, for the most part, the metro boundary is a little bit bigger, but generally urban or urban fringe. So back, some of you may remember hearing about the 2040 plan, back when 2040 seemed like it was a really long ways off, and now not so much anymore. Like, I feel like I'll blink and it'll be 2040. But about around 1990, they started this idea of having a 50-year plan, you know, for the Portland metro region, and did this 2040 plan. And then what ultimately came out of that was the adoption of what's called the Urban Growth Management Functional Plan, which is a really fancy way of saying land use regulations that cities and counties in metro have to implement in order to be consistent with metro's requirements. Of particular interest for this, it does a lot of things, but what's of interest for this discussion are two particular titles. Title 3, which is water quality and flood management, and Title 13, which they call nature in neighborhoods. Title 3 came first. Most of what I know about the sort of development of these regulations is secondhand information. I was not involved in those discussions at Metro at that time. That wasn't what I was doing in my career at that time. You know, I was like a new planner who would never have been the person sitting at the table at Metro. But it's my general understanding that they might have pursued the Title III regulations first precisely because they're not statewide planning goal 5 regulations. They were adopted to implement those other two goals, the air, water, and land quality goal and the hazards goal. And as a result, they don't function much like a goal 5 program. They're not reliant on a particular map. There are mapped resources that are a guideline, but in the end, when we're implementing those water quality regulations, they apply based on field verified conditions. So if we discover that there's a water resource, meaning a wetland or a stream, that we didn't know about or that didn't make it on the map, we can still potentially regulate that under these regulations. Title 13 then came later. That's a regular Goal 5 program for habitat protection associated primarily with water features. So again, we're talking about wetlands and we're talking about streams. There is also an upland habitat component that does not apply in Clackamas County currently. It would apply if we had new urban areas that we were planning. So for the most part, cities will be the ones that will implement those upland habitat protections in areas that are newly urbanized, but they did not go back and retroactively apply those to areas that were already urban. These two titles overlap, and this is one of the areas where our regulations are incredibly complicated and we almost don't understand them, but they are two completely separate sets of regulations, one for Title III and one for Title 13, that very often regulate the exact same wetland or the exact same river or stream corridor, but the rules aren't quite the same. So it can be somewhat frustrating to navigate for both staff and the public. But the bottom line is we were required to come into compliance with both of these sets of regulations from Metro. So even though the state at that point would have said, hey, Clackamas County, you're in compliance. You've been in compliance for, you know, some period of years now with these regulations at the state level. Once Metro said, you know, we're going to voluntarily develop a program to protect Goal 5 resources and to do more in terms of water quality and flood management, then those became requirements for the urban and urban fringe areas of the county, not the rural area. So that's part of what this question of what applies in the urban area versus the rural area. We'll talk more, but the short answer is the regulations in the rural area or in the urban area are much more robust than the regulations in the rural area. And there are several reasons for that, but one of the reasons is because of the distinction between Metro having jurisdiction and not. Okay, let me just look at my notes real quick to make sure that I didn't
I'm not leaving something out, but I really wanted to hit on this.
Carrie has a question also, Jennifer.
Okay. Give me one second, Carrie. I just want to make sure. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So when, and I was looking back at my agenda to try to remember which property or which topic that we were talking about. There was a property with a clear stream on the very far edge of that lot that was not identified as of interest for whatever action that we were doing. And I just honestly can't remember, and I can't find seem to locate it right off the bat.
Sure.
If it wasn't identified as Goal 5, because I get that you have to have inventoried it before, but why didn't that get catch on the Title 3 filter when this action was happening last year?
I suspect because it was in the rural area. I think it was, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it was the Comprehensive Plan Amendment and Zone Change for the Peace in Eagle Creek that Melissa Ahrens was the staff person on, and Martha was there as well. So it was going from like RFFI to rural industrial or something like that, I think.
Right.
So that's the reason. It's because of the location. It was not in the metro boundary.
Okay. So how – so the county doesn't regulate those at all then? If you're outside – if you're in unincorporated Washington County area, whether you have stream on your property or not is of no consequences when it comes to developing your land.
I wouldn't go that far, but I will say we at the county level, if it isn't on the National Wetlands Inventory and it's not identified as a RISCA, which we'll talk about in a minute, but that's the Goal 5. So if it's not in our Goal 5 inventory for streams or wetlands, and for wetlands, that's the National Wetland Inventory is what we use, then there would be no clear regulations. Is there a way to get at the water quality piece? Maybe. I can get specific and open up my code, and when we get to that, we're going to talk about that section of the code, and I can kind of tell you what it says. But I think the concern is it's pretty vague. So maybe you could do something.
Well, I guess my point is it's more than just water quality. If you have a stream running down in your property, there's a significant potential for flooding and therefore property damage, depending on how your lot is developed, your right. land is developed. And if we're not doing any sort of regulations associated with those resources, it's more than – and wetlands – I can guarantee you that more than 70% of the wetlands have not been mapped, especially if you're only relying on the National Wetland Inventory. It'd be different if you were looking at local wetland inventory, and even that is somewhat spotty here and there. But it just feels like we're looking at a very small – through a very small filter of resources. Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that, and we can talk a little bit later about maybe why that is, and not that I'm trying to persuade you it shouldn't be different. I just can kind of maybe give you a little background about why it's the way it is.
Jen, I also have a question from Murph.
Sure.
Yes, I, Carrie, I think it would, the classification would change once, if it was a fish-bearing stream, then it would go to a state regulation, if I'm right. I know there's many streams up around my neighborhood that if they're bearing fish, they have a different classification on how forestry would treat the setbacks to these streams. And that's something that we recently had some issues with. or at least it came up. Another point is that that inventory of fish-bearing streams hasn't been taken up here since 1994. So they're way behind on identifying what actually is a fish-bearing stream. And yeah, so some of these streams are going without the protection they should have.
Okay, so I think just before I leave this slide, the key thing, because both of these titles trickle down then, and the county has zoning code regulations, separate regulations for both of these. And the important thing is that for Title III, it is, as I said, more of a field verified kind of thing. Whereas for Title 13, it's are you mapped or are you not? And then the areas that are protected, even though it might be the exact same wetland or the exact same stream, they don't necessarily protect the exact same areas. Some of them overlap. So Title III is a pretty linear sort of a thing. It's based on the size of the water feature. Is it a wetland or is it a stream? And if it's a stream, how many acres does it drain? And is it, you know, perennial or, then they look, it looks at slopes. So how steep is the terrain next to this water feature? And then you go through this calculation, and from that, you're measuring back a certain distance to create this buffer. So the buffer can be as much as 200 feet from what we call the break in the slope. But in any event, you could have a very large buffer, and you could have something if it's just a small stream and it's not sloped. You know, you might have only a 15 or 25. I can't remember. I always get mixed up between our regulations and the ones that WES applies, but it's something like a 50 feet or 25 feet is sort of the smallest. So the buffer then does control. You know, there's exceptions, of course, but generally you're trying to protect the buffer, and it's this kind of linear measurement. For Title 13, it's more about tree canopy. So they said, here's this water feature. We're going to protect certain types of vegetation near that water feature. It's about habitat, and so it's okay if it had tree canopy, and of course there's ways that Metro defines that, then it has higher protection than if it's just like already developed, for example. And so the standards are different depending on the value of the habitat that was there, and you can end up with these kind of, you know, blobs on the map essentially that you're regulating differently based upon what this tree canopy or lack thereof was. But the water feature is getting some protection regardless. It's just greater protection if there's more value to the vegetation that was there when this program started. So they overlap, but they're not identical. Okay, so now we're trickling down to the county. I guess some history. So, and recognizing, of course, that there's nobody left at the county that was around when this, at the dawn of land use planning when this all happened, right? And so anymore, it is kind of, I have to step back every once in a while and realize, like, most of the people who work at the county don't have any recollection that this even was a history, let alone would they have been there at the time. And so it's a little bit of a puzzle. They didn't always keep the best records back then. They didn't have computers, you know, it's like digging through hard files, trying to find, like, so sometimes it's like, I don't know if I can exactly tell you how the county was found to be compliant with all of these different goals that we're talking about. I just know we were. So there was what I'll call initial acknowledgement. Land use planning came about in the mid-70s. The statewide planning goals, the first 14, took effect in 1975. I may get this wrong. In any event, local jurisdictions started bringing their comp plan, you know, developing comprehensive plans and being, quote-unquote, acknowledged. So that's where the state said, yep, you've met the bar. And there were appeals and things got kicked back and it went on and on and on. But eventually the county was acknowledged and they said, you are compliant with all of these goals. The state then also adopted a process some years later called periodic review. The idea being, well, we weren't just going to assume that because you were acknowledged in, say, I don't know, 1982, that was always going to be good enough. There were going to be changes to state law. There were going to be changes in conditions in your jurisdiction. There was going to be potentially, as Carrie has mentioned, like better mapping, better, right? So we're going to make you periodically review your regulations and upgrade them, essentially. So Clackamas County got put into periodic review not that long after initial acknowledgement, which was kind of interesting. It took a long time for us to get completely acknowledged because there were a lot of appeals and challenges of individual zones on people's properties, not so much our regulations, but the actual, well, you zoned me EFU and I think I should be rural residential, those kinds of things. So it dragged on for some period of years. And then when we were finally acknowledged, we literally like took a breath and they said, now you're in periodic review. And we were in periodic review for more than 10 years. I don't remember exactly, but it took years and years and years to finish periodic review. And at that point, we were required to do some goal 5 work that we hadn't done before, or we were required to make it better because goal 5 had advanced. And so a lot of our environmental regulations actually were beefed up in the 90s. That's a long time ago now, but it was like the late 90s, I think, by the time our river and stream program was re-acknowledged. We had to do work with mineral and aggregate sites. There were some other, you know, some of these other more obscure ones where there was some stuff that had to happen. But the river and stream one was a pretty big deal. So we did make it through periodic review. And then at some point, I think based on probably a combination of maybe politics and lack of money, frankly, periodic review basically became a thing of the past. So while there are still periodic review provisions in state law, as they are drafted right now, Clackamas County will never go through periodic review again unless we voluntarily put ourselves in periodic review. So that happened. Wasco County just did that, and I don't know any of the background for why or whatnot, but they just finished theirs, and it was voluntary. There has not been, to my knowledge, any serious discussion of Clackamas County wanting to do that, but in theory, we could do it. So I'm not that familiar with the periodic review process. I didn't go through it the first time, didn't work on it, but it's where the local jurisdiction works with the state Department of Land Conservation and Development, and they evaluate our programs and say, okay, there's been these changes in state law, and you need to upgrade this stuff, or your population has changed, and so you need to look at this, and et cetera. But anyway, as a result, we haven't had any mandate from the state to do anything with our regulations since we finished periodic review in the late 90s. So the only thing that's come down the road since then were the metro regulations we talked about, where we did have to come in compliance with that functional plan, which did make those changes in the urban area. At the county level, our comprehensive plan has two chapters that clearly relate to things that are in goals 5, 6, and 7, like we talked, and 15, like we talked about. Chapter 3 is the main one, natural resources and energy. That covers all of our stream setbacks, the mineral and aggregate stuff, the wildlife habitat things, to the degree we have them, policies about noise and air quality. It's pretty thin, but there is stuff in there about that. Wetlands, all of that is in chapter 3. Then chapter 9 does have this goal 5 relationship because that's where our historic sites are and open space, but it's not so much the environmental piece that we're focusing on tonight. I just wanted to throw it out there that yes, we do have some of our goal 5 regulations in that chapter. And then there are other policies that pop up in other chapters that certainly have some overlap, but primarily that's where you're going to find it. So when you're evaluating like a comprehensive plan amendment and zone change where you need to find consistency with a comprehensive plan, it's going to be these policies, you know, that will likely appear in a staff report. For instance, on this question about the stream that you had, you know, was there a policy in chapter 3 that conceivably would have had some relationship to the application where you might have found, you know, we don't think it's consistent with that, or we think you need to make some changes to make it consistent. And I don't know the specifics, of course, of that site, but generally that would be the chapter if you were interested in reviewing it on your own, for instance, when you're going to get a staff report from somebody that says, you know, Melissa's going to write you a staff report that says, I think it's compliant, and maybe you're wondering, you know, Carrie, you had some questions. Chapter 3 would be a good place to look. Of course, that's on our website. And Melissa will typically pull out, you know, key policies and address those, but it's frankly not feasible to address every policy in Chapter 3 because it's, you know, whatever, 60 pages long or something. So we pull out the ones that are relevant, but maybe there's something, you know, that you think is relevant or that got missed. That would be the place to look. again, these tend to be, for the most part, not always, but the more broad policy statements as opposed to the real nitty-gritty of how the regulations actually work. So where the nitty-gritty of how the regulations work is in the zoning and development ordinance. And of course, you know, most of you, and even Kevin in his former role at the board, is very familiar with our zoning code and the fact that we come to you with code amendments and, you know, when somebody's doing a zone change, they have to meet the criteria for zone change that are in the zoning and development ordinance. Well, these are where the regulations are that people have to comply with when they come to us to say, hey, I want to do something on my property. So, again, I wish I could tell you it was completely clear-cut about what applies when, but you do tend to get this kind of patchwork of regulations. Sometimes they overlap, and sometimes, you know, the rural area not so much because there's less regulation. So what we have are a number of overlay zones. So you're going to have a base zone on the property, which is whatever it is. It's industrial, it's rural residential, it's exclusive farm use, it's commercial, whatever it is. And then on top of that, you could have one or more of these overlay zones that do a couple of things. An overlay zone can actually give somebody permission to do more on their property than they could otherwise do. An example of that is the mineral and aggregate overlay, right? You get a mineral and aggregate overlay on your property, you can mine it as opposed to the average person who can't mine their property. You get a historic overlay, for instance. You sometimes, depending on the zoning, get to maybe do something extra as far as certain types of conditional uses that we think will, you know, sort of help preserve that historic. You might be able to have a bed and breakfast in a place that somebody else couldn't. That type of a thing. It's pretty narrow, but there's some things you can do extra. For the most part, though, these overlays are more restrictive. They impose something extra. So we can have a quiz on what all these acronyms mean, if anybody's up for it, but it's a lot. So the first one is the Floodplain Management District, which Murph is very familiar with, and that, of course, has been historically a hazards type of thing, right? Not about environmental protection really at all historically, but about, you know, protecting life and property, frankly. So it has restrictions that basically apply to construction, applies to, quote, development. Most of the time it's because somebody wants to build something, but it can be because they want to grade in the floodplain, for instance. And it dictates certain part of the floodplain you can't build in at all. That's called the floodway. And are there exceptions? Yes, for certain water-dependent uses. For example, it's pretty hard to develop a dock that's not in the floodway, for example, something like that. If you have a home that is a non-conforming use, there's some ability to make some limited changes to that. But generally speaking, no new development in the floodway. You're not going to be able, if you have a property that's entirely in the floodway, you will not be able to build a home on it. Then there's the 100-year floodplain, which we regulate. People have to get permits. They have to go through a floodplain development permit before they can build in the 100-year floodplain. They have to elevate the first finished floor of a residential structure 2 feet above the base flood elevation. They have to design their foundation in a certain way. They have to protect their utilities in a certain way. We have some limitations on putting critical facilities. That's a fairly new addition to our code. Things like schools and hospitals and things are supposed to not locate in the floodplain if it's feasible for them not to. We do not regulate the 500-year floodplain. It's mapped, but there are no regulations that apply. Floodplain regulations, of course, are really a product of the National Flood Insurance Program. And so for the county to continue to be a participating member of the National Flood Insurance Program and give our residents access to insurance through that program, we have to remain compliant. So as a result of that, our regulations have been amended many times over the years, most recently just a couple of years ago. When FEMA develops new maps, we have to adopt the new maps, you know, so it's very prescriptive and there's an incentive to do it because we want our residents to be able to continue to get flood insurance. So Murph's going to know more about this than I do, but I will tell you historically, it really has been more of a protecting life and property. So right up until the National Wildlife Federation sued FEMA for their, and I believe that's right. I believe it's National Wildlife Federation, and they sued, it's specifically Region 10, which is, we are part of FEMA Region 10, arguing that the National Flood Insurance Program violates the Endangered Species Act. And they won. So as a result of that, the state of Oregon and FEMA have embarked on a rather lengthy project, and they are in the middle of it right now, to come up with a way to essentially fix this problem. And so as a result of that, our flood regulations are going to become environmental regulations, not just protect life and property regulations moving forward. I don't know yet exactly what that's going to look like, but we are going to have to change our floodplain regulations in all likelihood. And probably, I mean, they're just now like this sort of what they're going to submit back to, I think it's National Marine Fisheries Service that has to bless this, essentially. Because essentially they're saying that allowing all of this development in floodplains is posing unacceptable risk to endangered fish in the, right? And so that's really what it comes down to. And so they're in the process of coming up with some proposals for how local governments can become compliant. And it seems like they are going to take into account regulations we already have in place. However, one thing we don't do is, for instance, require people to develop outside the floodplain on their property if they can. We don't say that. If you have a property that's partially in the 100-year floodplain and partially not, we don't tell you have to develop in the not. And it seems like that might be coming as a one possible requirement that will be new for us. Mitigation requirements, like right now, if you build in a floodplain, there's no mitigation required for that. You just get to do it. You just have to, yes, you can't like put a bunch of fill in there unless you balance it with cutting another area. You can't, you know, you've got to build your house in a certain way. But there's nothing that says you have to go and beef up the habitat because you built in a floodplain. So change is coming. This body will certainly be seeing those because it will be amendments, I'm sure, to our zoning code. But the time frame is probably still a couple of years out, I think. So our staff's engaged on that, but there will be changes coming. The second overlay is what I said earlier. We call it RISCA, River and Stream Conservation Area. It regulates both what we call our principal rivers. So those are the big ones, not the Willamette, but the other ones, the Clackamas, the Tualatin, the Sandy Salmon, the Malala Pudding. And that's been around for a long time, many, many, many years, and it imposes a buffer. So the buffer is, we regulate development that's within 150 feet of the river. We have a setback that's at least 100. We can require it to go up to 150. The criteria for deciding where you are in that is not very clear. But the minimum setback's 100. If you're beyond 150 feet from the river, we're not regulating you. So that's the de facto regulatory zone, is within 150 feet of the mean high water line of the principal rivers. There are exceptions. So we don't make a lot unbuildable as a result of those buffers. What we do is say you have to demonstrate to us that the lot is, you know, that the lot depth precludes meeting that setback, in which case you can locate within it, but there are some limits. We're not going to let you build the biggest house in the world. I mean, there's some caps on footprint, and we make you pull it as close to, you know, far from the river as you reasonably can, but there's a lot of discretion involved in that. It's a land use application. There's notice to neighbors. In addition to the principal rivers, we regulate streams, and these are the maps that Murph was alluding to. So they are called water protection rule classification maps, I believe. They're actually under the auspices of the Department of Forestry, which is odd to me because I would have thought it'd be like Fish and Wildlife or something, but they're not. They're Oregon Department of Forestry maps, is my understanding. They base this on, it's like the amount of water that's, they're fish bearing. So as Murph said, this is fish bearing streams, and they are classified in three different categories based upon how much water is flowing through them. So we have large, medium, and small streams with buffers of 100, 70, and 50, depending on which category. Those were that whole program for those streams was adopted during periodic review. It was the subject of some contention. There were some appeals. It was one of the last, if not the last, things that we had to do to be done with periodic review. But ultimately, the program was acknowledged, and so we've been implementing it now since 1997, I think, is when it was finally done. So again, same as with the principal rivers, there are exceptions. We're not making the lot unbuildable, but you do have some limitations. And if you can meet the setback, then you must meet the setback. I guess this is probably as good a time to talk about this. Because in the rural, well, let me talk about one more. So far we're talking in the floodplain, it's urban and rural. We have one set of floodplain regulations that applies in our floodplain everywhere. The RISCA is rural only, because once Metro adopted their regulations, there was no point in layering those on top of each other. So when we adopted the Metro regulations for Title 3 and 13, we said, okay, RISCA no longer applies in the urban area. It would have been redundant. So it's only outside the Metro boundary. So outside the UGB and those urban fringe areas that we talked about, like Stafford, that's where RISCA applies. And it applies everywhere in the rural area. So all the way up to Mount Hood, where Murph lives, and all the way down South County and, you know, the whole thing. The Willamette River Greenway also applies urban and rural. The standards are largely the same. There are different standards for docks and boathouses, depending on which side of the Oregon City Falls you're on. But the Greenway itself applies urban and rural. Same thing as the principal rivers. It's a buffer of 100 to 150 feet, depending. Again, the criteria are pretty vague about how you decide. There are standards for docks and boathouses. Docks are also regulated by the state and the feds, I believe. So it's like multi-layer regulation. We're not really doing the docks from an environmental standpoint so much. It's mostly like an aesthetic, how big, you know, how much water are you allowed to cover? How big can your boathouse be? And they have to get a floodplain permit for those as well as the greenway permit. The greenway is not, the regulations are not as tight as the, probably not quite as tight as far as what you can do in the buffer and as far as, But you still have to meet that setback if you can and all of that. So they're similar, but maybe not quite as good. So those are really the rural regulations. The floodplain, the RISCA, the Willamette River Greenway. There's also something called sensitive bird habitat. That's that SBH. We literally have two designated sites with heron rookeries. They're both rural. One's the Malala State Park. I don't know if I got that name right, but anyway, it's a state park, so there's really not a development pressure on that site. And the other one is on a privately owned property that I think is zoned timber. So again, there's really not development pressure there. Those are the only two sites that during periodic review we were required to designate under the Wildlife Habitat Goal 5 provisions, those two sites. Wetlands, that's the kind of other thing that you were talking about, Carrie. We do not have Goal 5 wetland regulations in the rural area. There is what I would call a safe harbor in Goal 5 for rural wetlands, which says if you basically adopt the National Wetland Inventory as your local wetland inventory for a rural area, and you notify the Department of State Lands, anytime someone is proposing development on a property with a designated wetland, that's it. That's your Goal 5 program for rural wetlands. And so that is what the county did, and that was sufficient for periodic review. There isn't any change. I mean, that is still what the rules say today. So we are compliant, but we have done no mapping, no local wetland inventory for the rural area. And have not adopted any kind of local protection program for those. So basically, it's the Department of State Lands and the Army Corps of Engineers that do permitting for rural wetlands, and we just notify them that one exists and somebody's proposing development on that site. The other thing that's important to know about rural, I said I get a little bit at this kind of history of, well, why is it like this in the rural area, right? So first off, and I'm not saying there'd be no value to it, but I'm saying a couple things. Commercial harvests of trees. So we, Clackamas County and all local governments are prohibited as a matter of state law from regulating the commercial harvest of timber outside urban growth boundaries. So essentially, we cannot tell people that they cannot cut down their trees. And that is entirely regulated by the Oregon Department of Forestry. They establish what stream buffers there are. I don't know what they are. I can certainly tell you anecdotally. I've, you know, read stories in the newspaper over the years that suggest maybe those buffers aren't big enough. But I don't know if that's true. I don't even know what they are, but I bet some people on the screen do. Tammy, what are the buffers?
Very similar to what you said. We harvested well over 100 acres and small, medium, large, 50, 100, 150 feet. They are regulated like nobody's business.
So that's a lot better than what I've been led to believe.
It is unbelievable. We had inspectors. I mean, we hired a timber manager, so he knew every rule known to man and all the taxes and everything. So ours was run pretty strictly. But anyone around here that's harvesting, yeah, you're under the thumb, let me tell you. And I've never heard of, and when you break rules, which we had a couple of those happen, you wish you hadn't. The fines, the taxes, it's very unpleasant. So, and it starts from the moment you begin cruising your timber and getting ready all the way through from spraying and then replanting. It's all very regulated. So it's the county doesn't need to be involved. I can tell you that right now.
Yeah. Well, that may very well have been, well, it wouldn't have mattered. We can't be, but again, there's no need to impose another layer if it's happening anyway, but the Oregon Forest Practices Act precludes us. So we are allowed to have a tree. If we want to have a tree ordinance in the urban growth boundary, we can. There are rules for how you go about doing that with coordinating with the Oregon Department of Forestry. But outside rural areas, the only thing we're allowed to do is on exception land. So meaning like if they are zoned rural residential, for instance, and say they come in to do a subdivision, we could require them to save some trees. We can say, don't cut those. But we can't do anything like telling them, if we were going to let them cut them, we can't be like, well, this is how you would do it. And then you have to replant, and you can't use pesticides, and we can't do any of that. But we could say preserve these. And occasionally that happens on a rural, you know, when we get a rural subdivision, that there's been a requirement to conserve some trees, you know, which could be on a stream buffer or whatever. But the reality is, if they do the harvest first, you know, that's allowed under the, and they would just follow the Forest Practices Act for that and then come in for development. The other thing is, we're pretty limited in our ability to restrict farming. Same thing, it's the whole right to farm, and, you know, so a lot of the rural land is zoned exclusive farming. So anyway, those are a couple reasons why I think we haven't done more. The other thing is just lack of resources. So, you know, when we did our urban wetland inventory, again, for periodic review, we hired a consultant. You know, we don't have the technical expertise on staff to do that, and it's an expensive project, and that was just for a very small part of the county. And then you think about trying to do that. I mean, presumably excluding the National Forest, obviously, that would be a big area removed, but still, it's a lot of area. And I think there just probably wasn't, you know, weren't the resources to do that. And then, of course, now there's Murph's very well aware of this, too, with his involvement with the channel migration zones and all. There's the question of, if we go impose new requirements and restrict people's development rights, you potentially open yourself up to a Measure 49 was what it was, claim. Now, that's, you know, it depends, because there's only certain cases where you can actually make a claim anymore, and they would have to do an appraisal and demonstrate that you've, you know, reduced their property value, and they have to show that it's preventing them from building a home or farm and forest practices. So we would have to be careful about anything new that we did in the rural area, but it doesn't mean that there's no possibility for it, just that, you know, we would have to be evaluating those issues to make sure we weren't opening ourselves up for claims of lost property value that the county would either have to pay or waive the regulations. So Okay, so that's what we have in the rural area. We have floodplain, we have river and stream buffers from inventoried fish-bearing streams from the inventory that, as Murph said, is from the 90s. We have a Willamette River Greenway, and we have a couple of regulated bird sites, and that's it. And the, we notify Division of State or Department of State Lands of development on wetland sites. So then the urban mix, same floodplain, same greenway, no bird sites. Instead of RISCA, we have HUCA, which is Habitat Conservation Area, and WCRA, which is Water Quality Resource Area. And those two correlate to the two metro titles we talked about. Okay, so Title 3, that's WCRA, Water Quality, Goal 6 and 7, like we talked about. And then HUCA, which is Habitat Conservation Area, that correlates to Title 13, that's the Goal 5 protection. So prior to metro regulations, the county had these rivers. We applied RISCA in the urban area, and we had a local wetland inventory and our own, what they called, we called them conservation wetlands regulations, which to the degree I remember them were generally, here's the designated wetland, there's a 50-foot buffer. I mean, that was essentially what it was. And that all came out of that full Goal 5 analysis that we talked about at the first slide, which is, you know, we did an inventory, we determined what qualified as significant, we decided in favor of or, you know, protecting the resource or not, and then we zoned these wetlands. So Metro used our local wetland inventory in their mapping, so that was an input, essentially. So we ended up consolidating, and we just, we don't apply those old wetland regulations, and we don't apply the rural RISCA stuff anymore. We just took these new metro regulations. We've modeled our regulations off the model code. So Metro created a model code for both Title III and Title 13. Unlike Washington County, so I am certainly not an expert on Washington County's regulations, but they already had a program or were in the midst of doing a program related to the Tualatin River, and that got basically sanctioned, if you will, as part of Title III, where they were told if you comply with that, that would meet our standards. We didn't have that situation, so we either had to use the model code or come up with our own program, and we didn't have the resources to come up with our own program. So we just took the model code, we kind of tweaked it to make it fit, you know, just structurally into our code, tried to kind of reorganize it a little bit and clean up some confusing parts. But basically, it is what Metro said to do for both Habitat Conservation Area and Water Quality Resource Area. The other sort of twist on this, and I have a bullet there, surface water management authorities. So when Title III, so again, that's the water quality piece, when that was adopted initially by Metro and we had a compliance deadline for it, it was actually the county's surface water management district, so CCSD number one, and at the time, trying to remember now, they adopted it. So WES, I mean, Carrie's familiar with WES, that's the county department, Water Environment Services, that essentially is like the umbrella over these service districts, which are somewhat separate from the county, that regulate surface water management in certain defined boundaries. So there were three or four of them, and frankly, I think some of them merged, and I'm not up on the latest. But the bottom line is, WES has authority. I think you asked me in an email, Carrie, whether there was any authority like in rural areas or something to that effect. Yes, WES has authority in the Tualatin River Basin, even in the rural area. It was called the Surface Water Management Agency of Clackamas County, and I'm not sure it's separate anymore. But they apply these regulations, these metro water quality regulations within that boundary, which is rural, and within CCSD, which is their urban, you know, Clackamas and not Oak Lodge, not Oak Grove, Jennings Lodge area. They have their own district. But anyway, the rest of the urban area and up at Mount Hood, where Murph lives, they have boundaries up there where they provide sewer and storm drainage. So even though the Mount Hood District wasn't subject to Metro's requirements. West went ahead and adopted those regulations for all of their districts. As far as I know, they're still doing that. I haven't heard that it's different. So the only place that the county was initially non-compliant with Metro's water quality requirements was in the Oak Lodge. At the time, it was called the Oak Lodge Sanitary District, which is basically the area around McLaughlin, between Gladstone and Milwaukee. And they had some wetland requirements, I think a 25-foot buffer, but beyond that, they weren't really applying the full suite of Metro regulations and didn't want to adopt them the way that West was willing to do. And so we were non-compliant for some period of years. I don't really know all the history of that, but there was some time where we were trying to get into compliance. And so it wasn't until 2009 when we adopted the Habitat Conservation Area regulations that we adopted the water quality regulations for outside West's boundaries. So those only apply where West didn't already have jurisdiction, and West is continuing to apply. Their standards are very similar to our standards, but there are a couple of minor distinctions, and our staff actually implements those requirements through an IGA with West, so that we're talking, so that basically an applicant can come to us and find out about the habitat stuff and the floodplain stuff and the water quality stuff all at the same time. So there's an IGA for us to do that, but technically they're West regulations that we're applying for water quality within their boundary. Murph's got a question.
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. Do you charge stormwater management fees in those areas?
As
West charges stormwater management fees.
And we don't, but I don't know if Oak, because Oak Lodge, it's now called, so Oak Lodge Water Services still has jurisdiction over sanitary and storm within that boundary. They just don't apply the water quality standards. So the buffers, basically, and the mitigation requirements. So we apply those, but they would still be the ones that would be assessing whatever fees, you know, SDCs or whatever they've got, impact fees. The district would be doing that, but the county is not doing that.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Jennifer?
Yes?
When you're done with this slide, do we want to take a 5-minute break?
I think this is it.
Oh.
This is the last one.
Okay. Oh, didn't know. I just was,
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. I'm wrapping up.
Okay. Okay, great.
But I think
Kelly's
got a question.
Yeah, so I'm really sorry because this is probably a really, really dumb question. When you say rural, is that equivalent to unincorporated Clackamas County?
No.
How are you defining rural in, like, unincorporated Clackamas County?
Yeah.
That's a dumb question.
So unincorporated just means you're not inside city limits.
Okay.
So we, you know, the Clackamas County Planning Department has no authority inside city limits. So our zoning code does not apply in any city.
Okay.
But it applies to all of the unincorporated area. Now, the regulations themselves, though, even though the zoning code applies, we don't have the same regulations, right? So there are things that apply in the urban area, things that you can do in the urban area, ways we zone property in the urban area that are very different than rural, even though they're both unincorporated.
Okay.
So urban means inside an urban growth boundary. In our case, really I'm talking about inside the Portland metropolitan urban growth boundary. So for us, that's basically McLaughlin Boulevard between Gladstone and Milwaukee, between those city limits, that's ours. The whole, like, Oakfield Bridge and 82nd between, you know, the whole, like, that whole Clackamas Town Center area and all the way up 82nd to the Multnomah County line is nearly all unincorporated. I mean, you get into Milwaukee and you get into Happy Valley the farther you go off of 82nd, but that whole core area is ours. There's still a lot of what's out along Sunnyside Road that's unincorporated. Happy Valley has certainly annexed parts of it, but there's lots of neighborhoods, between 205 and Damascus basically, not quite as far as Damascus, but like 152nd, a little bit beyond 152nd. So that's our urban area. The other thing we have is the area over, there's Lake Grove. There's still an area of Lake Grove that's not in Lake Oswego.
So one other question that I have is, I know that at Washington County, under Clean Water Services, they not only have regulations about how you define how far the buffers are, they also have regulations for actually restoring and or mitigating those buffers to good condition if they're not in a good condition scenario. Do we do something similar to that, or is that just limited to protection only type of a scenario?
So in the rural area, there are no mitigation requirements. We enforce the buffer, but we don't make you bring the buffer up to standards. So the only exception to that would be if somebody goes in and messes with the buffer, which happens pretty often, right? We get code enforcement complaints that somebody has gone into the buffer and impermissibly, you know, removed vegetation or whatnot. Then we will require some mitigation as a way to remedy the code enforcement situation. Mm-hmm. But if you just historically have a buffer that's not what we would really ideally like to see, there's nothing out there that requires them to upgrade it.
Okay.
In the urban area, I need to look, because there are mitigation requirements, yes. But what I can't remember is if you – I don't know that you have to do any mitigation unless you're actually developing the buffer. So I think you start with, here's the buffer – and then it's like, well, if you're going to stay out of the buffer, just stay out of the buffer. But if you want an exception, then there's these mitigation requirements that kick in. And I believe that's correct, but I can check the code here in a minute and let you know for sure.
Okay. Thanks, Jennifer.
Yeah. So, Louise.
Okay. Now I'm unmuted. I have two things. Tammy was talking about her experience with the harvest or logging, and sounds like she had a very different experience than what I had. I didn't harvest or log, but one of my contiguous neighbors, the large lumber company that borders my property, did do a clear cut some years back, and they came over the line, crossed a fence onto my property, harvested my trees, and it was completely lawless. There was no regulation. There was nobody watching anything. Now, there was no stream involved. So I want to ask, is this, sounds like oppressive presence of regulation only there when there's a stream or something else? Because there was strictly nothing going on when it came to protecting me from them harvesting onto my property. And unless I want to litigate it constantly, I have that issue. So I want to know, I mean, I'm not here to talk about my personal issue. I want to know, is the enforcement and the regulations only around streams?
And I can answer part of that. I'm sincerely shocked, because any of the companies, Port Blakely's, Willamette Trees, all of them pretty much always survey and make sure even an existing survey is brought up to current before they cut. I mean, when we harvested, we had all of our property surveyed, and a bunch of our property was along Port Blakely. And we called them and said, we're surveying and it's going to be your line too. They kicked in 50% of the fee to do that. So really am shocked. I know BLM does it. That's over the top. But the other side of the coin is, they cut your trees, you're sitting in the driver's seat. I mean, there are laws that protect it. You get like 4 or 5 times the stump cost, and you get reimbursed for all those trees. They have to replant. They have to do. So if you haven't, you need a lawyer, because I have never heard that happen from a logging company. So I'm sorry, Louise. That just breaks my heart.
None of the companies you mentioned, the smaller. Oh. Smaller company, obviously local. And, you know, I just wondered if though all that you know, following the laws and everything and people coming to inspect, how to do more with like stream regulations that when there's just a harvest and the, you know, the land is just,
yeah,
dry land between two neighbors, nobody comes to look. It looked,
yeah, there isn't any state law about surveying. There just isn't. But as I said, any company or any landowner with wherewithal, absolutely, you survey before you do it, because to do what happened to you, to cut on somebody else's land, oh my Lord, all your profits go out the window because it's so expensive to fix what they've done. So anyway, so interesting, Louise. Sorry to hear that.
So what you're saying that a lot of that is voluntary rather than the government coming in with actual inspectors every time there's a harvest.
Not yet. Not the boundary. They, you know, that's really up to all the property owners. We went to every property owner that touched our property, and no one wanted to share in the cost except for Port Blakely. But the point is, no, that's not regulated. That's really more common sense. What was regulated for us was, yes, mostly streams, and we had a lot of streams on our property, so that was a big deal for us. But then also the afterwards, after we were done, all the slash piling and burning, all of the spraying, reforestation, it isn't as regulated as you need to meet these requirements, and if you don't, you don't get your timber deferral. So that's kind of the carrot that they hold out. You need to make sure that you follow there, and then you get your deferral. You keep your deferral. Excuse me, let me put it that way. So, interesting.
Yeah. My other comment question was about the fact that Clackamas County has formed a climate advisory task force, and I'm wondering how our, you know, the Planning Commission and the Climate Advisory Task Force are going to be doing some interfacing about environments and harvesting. To me, you know, as an environmentalist, it's very important. And I assume the Climate Advisory Task Force was formed for that purpose, to look at things that will help with abating bad things with climate change. So I just wondered how that's going to be, you know, are they going to meet with us? It involves what we're talking about tonight.
And the short answer is I don't know, but we're trying to find out. So I asked, this had come up, I think, at the work program discussion that you all had, where there was this interest in the climate action plan, and that's what this task force is obviously related to. So they're going to come, the team that's doing that work from the county is going to come and talk to you. I had hoped they could do that tonight, but I don't even know completely, but some sort of a delay in their public outreach program with their consultant and whatnot. So they weren't ready to do it yet. But when they are ready, we'll have them come and do a presentation. And I think that will give all of us a better sense of exactly what are the parameters. I mean, they're coming up with a plan. So what's happening right now is not actually changing any rules. It's just, here's the plan of how we get the county to being carbon neutral by, I don't remember the year, 2050, something like that. And I think it would make sense to me that some of their recommendations or some of what ends up in the plan could have to do with land use regulations. That seems like that could be a piece of it, but I have no idea what those might look like at this point. So I think we want to start with understanding the scope of their project, and so we will get them to come and speak to you.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah. Murph? Maybe we should take the break, Tammy. It's up to you.
You know, my neighborhood's pretty special, as you know, Timberline.
I know.
Which does not have the setbacks that you have described, even for major streams. And if they did have the setbacks, the channel migration zones movement has taken those. So now how do we adjust to meet the county standards? We don't. And, you know, we're built right on up to the river, which is a very serious issue. Right now we have the maps that show the channel migration zones, mm-hmm. and they could be layered on top of FEMA,
mm-hmm.
but we've we've had, as you know, you sat at the table too,
I did.
With regulatory to come up with a plan to ask the state to look at giving local government backbone to regulate these channels that are really a high danger, and the populations are still growing in these channel migration zones, and someday it's going to happen that we're going to have some serious property loss, and I hope not life loss, but that's very, very possible.
So what Murph's talking about, well, a couple things. So yeah, the setbacks that apply in the Mount Hood area on paper are the same as they are everywhere else. It's still 50, 70, 100, and up to 150 from, you know, the Sandy Salmon, but it's that recognition that where you have lots that can't be built on with and meet that setback, then there's this exception process where you still get to build. The lot is not rendered unbuildable. That is the nature of our regulations. But the other thing that, you know, that Murph's mentioning are these channel migration zones. So the idea being, and this is the non-techie explanation, the river, I mean, this could happen. It's not, this river isn't the only one that does that, but in the world, but it's in Clackamas County, it's the big one that moves. It doesn't stay in one place and occupy a more or less set channel over time. It literally has dramatic events occur, and it will just literally shift course in a matter of, I mean, very rapidly. So it's pretty scary. And they have mapped this channel, what they call the channel migration zone up there. And there was discussion at the board about potentially considering doing something, adopting the maps formally, regulating potentially within that area. I haven't heard anything about that recently. Certainly we still have the maps, but there's been no regulatory program adopted. There obviously are concerns about, because potentially it's not something that you can construct your way out of. It's a little different than saying, well, I'm in the 100-year floodplain. I'll just elevate my structure above the base flood elevation, put foundation vents in, protect my utilities, you know, et cetera, and weather the storm, so to speak, as opposed to, oh, the whole river just moved. I don't know that you can engineer. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but I would question that you can engineer your way out of that. And so it might be a matter of saying you don't get to build on that lot anymore. Or you lose your house and you don't get to put it back. And that is a very politically contentious property rights question. And I think that's how you could kind of sum up where the board ended up on that. And this has been a couple of years ago. It was the last time I was involved in any kind of discussion. So at the moment, there is no imminent plan to adopt the channel migration zone, but I'm not saying it'll never happen or that it's, you know, that it's dead. And I don't know if this biological opinion thing from this lawsuit, one of my staff people mentioned in passing that I got the impression that maybe the channel migration zones were going to end up being an issue for that. So we'll see, Murph. There could be something coming. I don't know what exactly.
But I wrote twice to the Anne appeared a couple times for that biop. And, yeah, the last I heard, they're not going to go after channel migration zones.
Yeah.
I have heard of resurrecting the projects to try and minimize the channel migration zones by removing or opening up some of the levees that had channelized the river. After the 1964 flood, the Sandy River was channelized with push-up levees, which created a fire hose effect as far as erosion-wise. They condensed the stream to an extremely powerful flow. The Sandy has a drop of, in the first 13 miles, has a drop of 300 feet per mile. So you can imagine the velocity this river can reach. And when you add water to the cobble that surrounds it, it just disintegrates. So the Sandy River Watershed Council has a couple projects where it's opened up the levees that were pushed up back in the 60s to allow the river to access its floodplains. But we're very limited to where we can do that. We have to have the properties to do that. But there's a couple areas upstream that Clackamas County owns the property, and disaster management was talking about resurrecting or putting efforts in that direction to put some demonstration areas up there again. We'll see what happens.
So let me just summarize this. I'm just going to wrap this up, Tammy, real quickly, and then we can decide what you want to do. Essentially, those overlay districts are the strongest regulations we have for the most part. There are some almost what I would call random regulations in a couple of other sections of the zoning code. We have some pretty good regulations for developing on slopes or landslide topography where you have to do a geotechnical if it's over a certain slope or if it's in an area that's identified as a landslide hazard. Our landslide maps are old and need to be updated, so there's that. They're very old. There's newer LIDAR data that the county has not adopted, but we have it available. We, you know, disclose to people that it exists, but we're regulating from older maps. So there are times we require a geotechnical review and revegetation of slopes and that kind of thing. So we do have those. We have some limited tree regulations, tree protection unassociated with streams, so just random trees. But they're not very strong, and they're even more problematic now because they're not clear and objective, and we're not allowed to apply them to residential development anymore under state law because they're not clear and objective. So that's going to have to be looked at if the board or whatever wants to do something different in lieu of those regulations. They work better for commercial and industrial development, but in any event, some tree standards. Other than that, there's not much here. There's just a bunch of kind of old remnant things that I think were part of Goal 5 compliance back in the 80s, and they're not founded in any really great basis at this point, and I don't think they come up very much because most of the stuff is in pretty remote rural areas where there's no development happening really anyway, so they're not really on our radar screen much, but there are still standards there. And we don't have anything good for wildfire hazards except state requirements when you're building in timber zones to do defensible space. I suspect that might be changing as a result of state legislation, so stay tuned. There's a bill that would create more defensible space standards statewide, so I don't know for sure what it's going to be, but it's probably coming. So that's that, and then I already mentioned, yes, our surface water management authorities, primarily the districts that are run by West, do have these water quality regulations, and ours don't apply when theirs do, but they're basically the same, for all intents and purposes, the same. And then the county does have to comply with federal and state, you know, we notify Department of State Lands, there's joint permitting that goes on with things related to wetlands and waterways that are through the Army Corps of Engineers and the Department of State Lands, so we coordinate with them. And the county, I know almost nothing about this, but Carrie will probably nod. Total maximum daily load requirements that come from the state regarding water quality. Certainly the county does have to do, you know, we have to do reporting on that. And we have an MS4 permit related to stormwater discharge or whatnot. And I don't work on that, but we're compliant with that as well. So there are things that are going on. And I guess my basic point is, above the county that we're coordinating with for compliance. So, and I guess maybe I'll just conclude by saying I think anything that's going to happen on environmental regulations in the foreseeable future, unless something happens at Metro or the state that I don't see yet, okay, because it could come, I don't know, but at the moment, the only mandatory thing I'm aware of is this biological opinion because of the lawsuit and the Endangered Species Act where we are going to have to do something in floodplains. Other than that, anything we embark on is optional at this point because the state does not see us as out of compliance and Metro does not see us as out of compliance. We meet the requirements. So anything we would do would be optional. And so then you're into the question of how does the county allocate its resources and what are the politics of that? And that's what comes up whenever you look at the work program every 2 years. What gets prioritized and what is politically possible?
I believe that
I talked a lot.
I have a question about TMDL.
No, I don't know the answers. I only know what it stands for, but maybe Carrie knows.
Total daily load. Total daily.
Total maximum daily load. It's what we're dumping in the river. That's the shorthand way of saying it, I think.
I'm attending a town hall tomorrow night and may be asked about what Clackamas County thinks about a new outfall into the Sandy River that currently is in the Clackamas River. City of Sandy is upgrading their wastewater treatment facilities, and they have looked at using Roslyn Lake as a man-made wetland, possibly, and also having an outfall at the Revenuers Bridge in just outside Sandy. Of course, the Watershed Council has something to say about that, since we're working on cold water refuge. And we like the idea of a man-made wetland, but the ground perks too much with the first tests that we have had. So we're gonna ask for more testing to find out if there's a way to slow down the perk so we don't have effluent going into wells. But anyway, if you don't know of any PMDLs, we've been looking with Metro, and there are, but they're further downstream than this particular location. So.
Yeah, I know the county does reporting. I'm not even sure who the point person is on that at this point. Sometimes, like, West does certain things, and then DT, my department's Department of Transportation and Development, does certain things, and they coordinate on certain things, and I actually don't know who the lead is on whatever requirement we have for responding, except to tell you it's not the planning department.
Okay.
I can probably find out.
Clackamas County is really, really confusing with MS4 permits. Very
that too. Yeah. There's too many jurisdictions. They all, yeah. Yeah, but I might be able to find out, Murph.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, do we want to continue with questions with Jennifer and then finish our agenda, or would we like to take a 5-minute break?
We don't have that much to go. I think on the, I don't know how many questions there are, but on the agenda, there's not much to go.
There isn't. We want to marathon through. Okay, let's do that then. Jennifer, wow, that was seriously a lot of information. You are a guru.
I would say we got an ocean, not a teaspoon.
Yeah. Thank you. The problem with this research, the little bit of research I did, most of that was just what I already knew, but I read through stuff today just to, you know, the goals and reminding myself. And all it makes me realize is how little I know. Which tells you how complicated all this stuff is, because I can talk for that long and still tell you I really don't understand it all.
Yeah. I know it well. We dealt with all those issues at the port as well. So.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, thank you. It gave us enough of a flavor as we move forward with hearings and stuff. At least we can be clicking in, oh, Metro 3 and 13, and oh, yeah, that's right, Measure 5. And so it just helped. This is a great foundation, and I'm sure it'll help us in the county in the future. All right, let's launch with the minutes. Did everyone get through the 5 pages? Good heavens. We are a busy commission. I didn't have any corrections myself. Anyone have? Oh, Murph has his hand up, but he's on mute. You're on mute. There.
Very top. The very top. Commissioner's present, Mary Phillips. 2 lines down, Commissioner's absent, Mary Phillips.
Oh, well.
She was either there or she wasn't. I think she was.
She was.
She wasn't.
I think we were just anticipating or something.
That's all.
Good catch. Wow.
Just to confirm, she was not.
I think. Is that the right meeting that she missed?
Yes.
Okay.
But look how clever she is. She made this meeting as well.
Any other corrections to the minutes? Okay. I think I would certainly encourage a motion.
Commissioner Schradl, move approval of meeting minutes.
Sorry, I got that.
I think that was Michael. Wonderful.
That's correct.
Great. Thanks, Michael. And any further discussion? Okay. All in favor? How about we just raise our hand? And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And Michael's not up. Michael, are you in favor?
I am in favor.
Okay. That would be 8 of us.
And I'll abstain since I was not a member of the commission.
Okay. We assume. Thank you very much, Kevin. All right. Very good. Other business. Summary reports of Board of County Commissioner actions.
So you had asked, I was hoping to get them to you by tonight, but I'm still waiting for one. So it had come up, I think, at your last meeting, this feeling that maybe things were going to the board and then there was no sort of closing the loop, like what happened and all of that. And so it had been our practice to do these summary reports. And I realized, I wonder if, at some point with the changeover in staff or COVID or whatever, we just kind of lost that. So I went back and I looked at everything that you had heard in the last year, roughly, and then reached out to there were several planners who had staffed those and said, hey, either find me the summary that you did before or write one if you didn't do one, and then I'm going to send them all to you. So there's like 6 or 8 of them, I think, and so I think I'm waiting for one more. And so I'll just email them all to you, but it will close the loop on everything you've heard in about the last year. And then you can hopefully keep going in that vein so that you don't miss that information.
I think it's really just valuable for us, once we hear something and give advice, and then to hear how it played out, but also if there were some interesting discussions that maybe we didn't have or we had and felt differently, I think it just, continues to develop our growth and understanding.
And I think for the most part, most of these, they just did what you recommended. So I don't think there's a lot of backstory. And a few of them had been drafted before, so you may have seen them, like they had them already in their files, or maybe they did them and then they just somehow didn't make it to you. So anyway, we will do a better job moving forward on this.
Jennifer, thank you. So we'll all see that separate on an email. Okay, good, good. All right, and then the Planning Commission on the back of your agenda is the, not a lot.
Yeah, everything just keeps moving, doesn't it? So there is no need to meet on June 14th. You don't have anything. June 28th, you will have a public hearing on a comp plan amendment and a zone change. I don't know exactly where I want to say it's on River Road, but I may be wrong. I can tell you it is in the urban area, and it is to go to high-density residential. I think it's low-density residential now. Anyway, it'll be going to high-density residential. That's the proposal. So Melissa Ahrens is staffing that, and she and Martha Fritzy. Martha will be covering for me because I'm on vacation that day. They will be with you on the 28th for a public hearing.
Wonderful.
And let's see. So then we're tentatively holding July 12th for a study session on the actual proposed code amendments, not just conceptual, but actual amendments to implement phase one of the housing project. That will happen if the board gives us the green light. They have a policy session on June 15th. And so we met with them with a very extensive planning session because a couple of them, of course, are new or returning and didn't have any of the background on this housing project. So we had a 2-hour planning session and talked about all phases of it and all of that. And then we were looking for the green light on phase one to move forward to hearing, and they wanted to have some individual briefings and get a little more into the specific strategies for that phase. And then we're circling back to the whole board for direction on whether they want to continue with those 3 strategies or not. So assuming the green light summer, all of those, we would have a study session on that on the 12th. And then July 26th will be the public hearing on Glenn's minor amendment package that you had the policy session about previously.
Perfect.
What we got.
Not too busy, but good to know we're still valued.
You're still needed, yeah.
Board of County Commissioners, anything coming up through them that we should know about?
So they don't have any hearings. They've got this, as I mentioned, the housing study session on the 15th, and then Park Avenue. The Park Avenue plan continues to just percolate. So we're going back to them on the, I believe it's June 22nd. Did she put that on here? Can't remember. June 22nd, I think it is, for for a policy session. They'd asked us to go do some more outreach with the business community about the proposed changes in the Park Avenue area. And so that happened. There were a couple of different public meetings held. And so now this is going back to essentially talk through that. What did we hear? What are the different options? The business community has some concerns. What might, you know, but we've got this community advisory committee that made a recommendation, you know. So they're going to talk about that on the 22nd. And so, again, if they green light something, then we would be looking probably at August to come get specific with you about what that is, you know, what code amendments we'd be looking at. So they have those two things, and then the comp plan amendment zone change that you got on the 28th of June, they will have on the 21st of July.
Great. Okay. All right. Anyone have any questions, thoughts, concerns? I didn't know, Jennifer, if you wanted to stay on after we adjourn with Kevin to talk about the Zoom.
Oh, yeah, if he's got any ideas.
Out. Okay, it looks like he's nodding. Great. But before we adjourn, I just want to make sure if there's – I personally found this incredibly valuable, and if anyone's thinking that they would like a more in-depth education in other parts of the planning, you know, speak now or later. We don't get it. That would be just great. I mean, I love this education, taking these opportunities. I think it just really makes us continue to be very valuable. Anyone have any questions or comments?
Okay. I would like to continue this.
Yes.
Later on. I think later on, I'd love to continue this talk.
Great. Actually. Good. Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead then and adjourn at 8:27. And then again, if you, Jennifer and Kevin or anybody else want to stay on and talk about Zoom. Stephen, good night. Thank you. Good night, everybody. Wonderful session. Jennifer, I don't know how you did it, but you did.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Thank you, everyone.
Excellent presentation. Thank you very much.
Good job.
Thanks.
Thanks.
See you in a few weeks.
Yep.